tell about this guy. You all know me as me scared as hell. He comes to me at night after I crawl into bed. He's burnt up like a weenie and his name is Fred. He wears the same hat and sweater every single day. And even if it's hot outside, he wears it anyway. He's gone when I'm awake, but he shows up when I'm asleep. I can't believe that there's a nightmare on my street.
A little Halloween medley to begin the show today, ending with A Nightmare on My Street. DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, a.k.a. Will Smith. The best horror movie franchise of them all, Halloween, followed by Friday the 13th, followed by A Nightmare on Elm Street. There was your little medley. I'm not the best producer, okay? You have to bear with me and forgive me, but I thought, what better way to start the show on this 31st of October than going through the themes of Halloween, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, followed by Nightmare on My Street. Happy Halloween. It is Thursday morning, the 31st of October. Welcome to the program. Far and away for me, Michael Myers from Halloween was the best horror movie slasher slash villain from back in the day. I didn't mind Jason Voorhees and the whole Friday the 13th story. Nightmare on Elm Street, absolutely my least favorite, although I consumed them all, because what else do you do as a teenager but watch all the movies that they provide you where they kill people in new and creative ways? Speaking of which, I was reminded again yesterday and have been reminded for many a year that I have to watch Tucker and Dale versus Evil, speaking of killing people in creative ways. So finally last night, I started. I didn't finish, not because I was terrified, but because I'm old and I try to sleep every once in a while, especially when time and scheduling permit. So I watched about half of it. I'm not entirely sure this is my cup of tea, but a couple of you said, you got to watch this movie. You're going to love this movie. I'm not sure I love it yet, but heck, I'm out there and I'm trying it. And what better way to spend Halloween time than watching scary and or hilariously scary slash gory movies like Tucker and Dale versus Evil. This being, of course, our Halloween show today, we will devote some time during the flip side this morning to hear all about your paranormal experiences. I've been thinking back on mine and I always thought I had at least one. I don't think it really was, though. I think I was just in a mood, but I know that you've got better, more sincere paranormal encounters to share with us on the flip side this morning at 11:30. And just as we get underway for another day here today, this is a reminder that your tax increase in Cambridge next year is 4.68%. Despite the headline number the city wants to share with you, it's actually 4.68%. And we'll talk more about that around 9:15. All right, let's get to your Farewell Show 5 for this Thursday morning. Number one, Vivek Goel will not be seeking a second term as president of the University of Waterloo. Goel says that after 25 years in senior leadership roles, he needs to prioritize time with his loved ones. Goel's term will end on June 30th, 2026. He's announcing his plans now to give UW time to find a successor. Number two, the region of Waterloo is considering changes in Elmira to improve transportation options and support growth. The improvements focus on changes to Arthur Street from King Street in Waterloo to Listowel Road in Elmira, as well as a potential new truck bypass. The goal of the enhancements is to improve safety while making intersection improvements that will support active transportation. Number three on your Farewell Show 5 this morning, one person was killed in a crash yesterday on the 401 in Cambridge. OPP say a wheel flew off a van traveling westbound, hopped the center median, and struck an SUV headed eastbound. A 39-year-old man from Toronto was killed. Number four, the city of Kitchener has approved two new developments with almost 600 total rental units. One project will see a 45-story tower rise on King Street at Pine, the site of the former CTV building across from Grand River Hospital. The other plan calls for an 8-story building on Victoria Street South between Henry and Park. And number five on your Farwell Show 5 this morning for the second time in five seasons. The Los Angeles Dodgers are World Series champions.
Here's the 1-2 pitch from Buehler. Got him swinging! That's it! It's a World Series win for LA! They've done it! They finished the job and give Los Angeles the parade it's been waiting for!
The New York Yankees had jumped out to a 5-0 lead last night, but could not hang on as the Dodgers battled back for a 7-6 win. And that is your Farwell Show 5 for this Thursday morning. When we come back, I know that you are a lot smarter than I am. So maybe you can help explain this to me, or you can tell me where I've gone wrong here. But what I have come to realize in recent days is that I think there should be uniformity in the way that municipalities across this region and across this province report to us tax increases. I find it, even as somebody who has followed it so closely for so long, I find it very confusing. And I think we should just get a top line number that is consistent from one municipality to the next. But like I said, you know better, like you're smarter than I am. So maybe you know why things get reported the way that they do. But I'm here for a top line number that is consistent so that when I'm comparing, say, Kitchener to Stratford, I know that we're comparing apples to apples. Am I asking too much in this? Like, I've got nothing against paying my fair share. I really don't. I believe taxes are investments in our community. I'm just confused as all get out as to where all the different numbers come from and why municipalities report it differently. Am I alone in this? Can you help me out a little bit? This is the Mike Farwell Show on 570 News Radio.
Skeletons and shivers down your spine. Shrieking skulls will shock your soul, seal your doom tonight. Spooky, scary skeletons speak with such a screech. You'll shake and shudder in surprise when you hear these zombies shriek.
We're so sorry. All right, let's talk a little bit about municipal taxes, if we can. It's no wonder it occurs to me sometimes that we feel as though in Canada we're being taxed to death. And I think this is a bit of a double-edged sword, and I'm truly happy to have you help me out in this, because the double-edged sword, I believe, comes from the interest in being transparent and letting us know all of the things that our taxes are paying for, and then at the same time reminding us that taxes are being collected for this thing, that thing, and then the other thing on top of it. What I would like, and this could just be my sensibilities, which is why I bring it to you for some consideration, but it would be really helpful to me. What I would prefer as a taxpayer is just sort of that top line number. And then if I want to take a further look, provide me the breakdown. Like, here's the link to say, okay, your tax increase, let's just say, is 4%, right? I'll use Guelph as the example because that's what we talked to Mayor Cam Guthrie about a week or so ago. He's using his strong mayor powers to say, listen, every department has to go through its budget so that we can deliver a 4% increase. And then if I want to see what goes into that 4%, by all means, I can look at the further breakdown. But I'll take you back to, well, let me start with what the city of Cambridge has done this year. And I'm sure, clearly, it's within the prerogative of the city to report this way, but it has taken out stormwater costs and just put it directly onto your utility bill, right? So instead of it being lumped in and becoming that 4.68% increase this year, the city's reporting 1.26% on the municipal tax levy. Then, oh yeah, then there's the 1% infrastructure levy. And then there's what would have been there if we were still including stormwater, but we don't. And so clearly the cities are given some latitude on this, and I'm not really sure why. So if I'm comparing Cambridge's rate to Waterloo's rate, I read a story this morning about the rate in Hamilton, and all I could think of is, well, but does that include stormwater? Because Cambridge has taken it out. Guelph doesn't include stormwater, I'm told, in its assessment rate. And I don't know why. I think that we should have certain things covered in that tax rate so we know. So it's apples to apples. I'll take you back to a conversation I had with a local mayor about their city's tax increase a year ago. And the mayor said, our tax increase is 5.5%. And I said, well, hang on a second. Your website, your city's website says your tax increase is 6.1%. So how do you get 5.5? And I was told 5.5% is the regional rate and the city rate combined. Add the utility rate and you get 6.1%. And I'm just smacking my forehead thinking, okay, so we've got a city rate, a regional rate, then a utility rate, then a stormwater rate. Where's the stormwater rate in this city? And how many times have you heard when we're talking about our regional budget that we're looking at trying to get it down to 8%, way too high, by the way. You know that 4.68% in Cambridge? It's not the worst number I've heard, even with that stormwater rate included. But this 8% rate that we're working to get down to in the region does not include the police budget. Now, I understand that the police budget is a big ticket item, but it's not like we talk about the regional rate and say, but it doesn't include Grand River Transit, right? The region has assumed at some point along the line, like I grew up in a region where Kitchener Transit used to be a thing and Cambridge Transit used to be a thing. So the region at some point decided it was going to assume responsibility for transit. And we know that it does. We know that it's a regional police service, but not a regional fire service and a regional paramedic service. Don't get me started. But we know what the region is responsible for. Just give us the top line number. Like it doesn't have to be exclusive. I just want to know what the rate is. And then you can break it down further for me if I want to take a closer look. But why do we just, I feel very confused and I feel very overwhelmed is what I'm getting at. And I'm not sure why we report it this way. And we report it differently from one municipality to the next. Like, am I the only one that feels this way? Just give me the number, please. And then if I want to learn more, by all means, you should break it down. But every municipality should break it down in similar fashion. This is the top line number that the municipality is collecting from you. Here's the increase to wages and operations at the city. Here are the here's our capital budget. Here's our operational budget. Here's your education levy. I just want one number, and then let me see what's contained within it. I feel like I get numbers reported differently from one municipality to the next, and I find it frustrating, and I find it confusing, and I find it overwhelming. And I just don't understand fully why we do it this way. Maybe I can learn a little bit more about this. Maybe you know why it's done this way, and I'm more than happy to hear. But for me, just give me the top line number, and then let me go into it and see where that top line number comes from. But that top line number has to be the same reporting as it is in another municipality. When I read the story this morning about Hamilton's 6.9% tax increase, all I could think of is, but does it include stormwater? Because apparently they don't include stormwater in Cambridge and they don't include stormwater in Guelph. And oh yeah, by the way, I get told time and again, Kitchener's tax increases are quote unquote artificially low because they own their own utility. Well, I help a guy out here. I want to pay my share. I get overwhelmed by all of the numbers. And I like numbers. I like them. But there's a lot going on in there. And it seems like it gives municipalities too much latitude to report in a way that makes it look more favorable for them. And I don't think that should be the case. I think it should be standardized across the board. And if it is standardized and I'm missing something here, help a guy out, because I'm confused as all get out. This is the Mike Farwell Show on 570 News Radio. Emailing Paul, pardon me, tells me that he understands the frustration when your employees won't give you a straight answer because we hire the politicians, you see, by electing them. And then we can't get consistency on the application of taxes or the understanding of the what I would like to see, the top line number. Emailing Paul suggests I have a butter tart to feel better. Let's go to calling Paul instead on the phones this morning. Good morning, Paul.
Morning. Listen, it's so easy, even a caveman can understand it. There's an old saying, figures lie and liars figure. All the politicians are trying to pass the buck or take away the buck from the other ones. Everybody wants to blame somebody else for the increases. They don't want to admit that it's their foolish spending habits. You know, if they ran their households the way they run governments at any level, municipal, regional, provincial, federal, if you ran your household like they do, you would be bankrupt in no time.
Yeah, I hear you. And I got to run to get to news. But this is where I get even more frustrated, because I don't believe that's entirely the case. But this is the impression that we're left with. I don't know. A top line number. Could we get there? Consistent reporting from one municipality to the next. Surely provincial legislation could provide this to us. An update from the 570 News Center, and then the return of the KW Symphony. Let's talk about it on the Mike Farwell Show. This is 570 News Radio. Just over a year after filing for bankruptcy, the KW Symphony has emerged from the other side of it, and the curtain will rise on a new season of music here in the region. Bill Poole is the chair of the board at the KW Symphony and joins us for a conversation. Mr. Poole, good morning.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. But I think more importantly, how are you? How does this feel?
It feels wonderful. I'm great. And there's great excitement among those of us who've, been working away at this, the board, which is fairly newly elected, as you know, June 6th, but and the musicians, who, without whom this never would have happened. It was the musicians who absolutely refused to let go right back on, a year ago in September. So we really owe it all to them. And the board is delighted to have been elected and played a role in kind of bringing the bankruptcy to its end.
How did we get here, Bill? What had to happen to bring this bankruptcy to an end?
Well, there was a the process, which I knew nothing about before getting involved, involves sending a proposal to creditors to tell them, with a proposal to tell them what, if anything, we have to offer them. And in this case, we had nothing to offer the unsecured creditors. So that proposal went, and 2-3 weeks later, there was a meeting, I think mid-September. And so the meeting, which was an online or Zoom meeting, there were no objections to the proposal. So the proposal then went forward to the Superior Court in London. And a while ago, a judge, since there were no objections and everything was in order, declared that the bankruptcy was annulled. So we have all the documentation now with that. And it means that the Kitchener-Waterloo Symphony Orchestra Association, Inc., full name of the organization, has gone from being bankrupt to not bankrupt. And we are debt-free and able to start doing business as the KWS again.
What does doing business as the KWS look like? How many shows will we see? How does that work?
Well, it's actually too soon to tell, Mike. You saw in the release that there's a concert at St. Matthew's Lutheran Church on November 16th. We hope people will come to that. And then two holiday concerts on December 20th, 21st. And these have been planned by the musicians and with our full support, but they are, in fact, have been funded completely out of their own GoFundMe campaign. So, and if the bankruptcy had been delayed until February or something, these concerts still would have gone ahead. But now that we're back in business, we're kind of presenting them, but just want to give credit to the musicians. And we will be able over time, of course, to let you and the community know what's to come. But at this point, we are we're really having got this bankruptcy behind us. We're now ready to begin a visioning process to either kind of reimagine what the KWS will be in the community in 2025 and beyond, to ensure that we have a sustainable operating working plan so that we don't run into any of this kinds of problems that brought down the last iteration of the symphony. So we have a huge amount of planning to do before really I can say anything about where to from here, other than we'll get on with it, and we'll certainly hope there will be music along the way, but it's going to take quite a while before we know what the new KWS will look like.
Is that to say then, Bill, that perhaps an evolution occurs here and the sorts of traditional, if you will, Saturday night or matinee concerts at the center in the square will be no longer?
Yes, I think that's quite possible. We have no plans to be back in the center in the square anytime soon. So for the foreseeable future, St. Matthew's Lutheran Church will be our kind of performance home for the moment. But over time, I can imagine many other performance spaces, which actually the musicians had used during the year of bankruptcy. So, yeah, I think all bets are off with respect to what was. We really have to, we have a clean slate, we have no debt, and so we really have to think very, very carefully about how this wonderful symphony organization can best relate to the community in many, many ways.
Does that speak generally also to the state of arts and culture in our community today, where we are, I think, looking for innovative new ways to attract and or appeal to audiences?
Yes, to my mind, it absolutely does. I think so much has changed. Well, the pandemic precipitated a lot of significant change, but change was in the works, in the air anyway. And so, yes, I think finding new ways of attracting audiences, finding new audiences, diverse programming and approaches, I think that's all what we now, I would say, have the luxury to with the musicians to and the community to reinvent. And so, for me, I've gone from a year ago and, you know, total despair with the symphony being apparently gone, and now to being it back. And so now having it back. And so now I see that we collectively have a real opportunity to, to address those issues that you've articulated. So much has changed in the way people relate to in buying patterns and all that kind of thing. So we now have an opportunity, and we want to capitalize on that and have something that's going to be really, really wonderful for the community and the musicians going forward.
You alluded earlier, Bill, to that GoFundMe campaign that had raised hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yes,
what does that community support tell you?
It tells us, I think, that it is there. It's very deep. It's very entrenched. And that just remarkable that they went from, you know, zero to 500,000. I really think it speaks to the level of commitment within this community, quiet commitment to having an orchestra. And so I think as we begin to conceptualize and articulate an exciting artistic plan for the organization, coupled with a very viable case for support and operating plans. I think the support for us will come back as we rebuild trust and show audiences some really exciting new music in the sense of new ways of perhaps presenting symphonic music and attracting audiences.
We certainly look forward to listening again and being a part of this evolution. Congratulations, Bill, and thanks very much for making time for the show this morning.
Okay, Mike. Thanks for your ongoing interest.
You bet. Enjoy the day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
Bill Poole is the chair of the KW Symphony Board, and the curtain rises again. It's really interesting. I think it's going to be really interesting to see, to hear, in this case, when we're talking about the symphony and symphonic music. But to hear, to see where this does go. No intentions at this point of returning to the center in the square anytime soon. So what does this mean for the future of our KW Symphony in terms of where it presents its music to us? What kinds of environments? I've shared before one of my favorite, and I've seen several shows, performances from the KW Symphony over the years, and one of my favorites was a smaller group of the symphony players performing at the opening of the newly renovated main branch of the Kitchener Public Library on Queen Street. Now, this goes back many years, but that performance really stood out to me because it was just a nice addition to a really important evening, with that main branch being renovated and reopened to the public, and just it fits so well. But also to have the symphony performing in that different setting, a smaller version of it. It wasn't the full symphony, but I wonder if that's not the sort of thing we're going to be seeing more, the symphony in different and or unique places in the community. But the curtain rises again as they have emerged from the ashes of bankruptcy. This is the Mike Farwell Show on 570 News Radio.
Now I see that we collectively have a real opportunity to address those issues that you've articulated. So much has changed in the way people relate to in buying patterns and all that kind of thing. So we now have an opportunity, and we want to capitalize on that and have something that's going to be really, really wonderful for the community and the musicians going forward.
Debt-free and out of bankruptcy is our KW Symphony, and the chair of the board, Bill Poole, says all of the credit goes to the musicians who just refused to let go. It had to have something to do with that proposal as well that was accepted by the creditors, and now the KW Symphony is back. What exactly it looks like, we're not entirely sure yet, but that visioning process, I'm sure, is underway a little further than Bill would allude to this morning. But no doubt there are things to still be sorted out as the symphony returns to our ears in various ways in the community. Let's go to the phones, hear from you. John, good morning.
Hi, Mike. I'm going to preface this by saying I haven't followed this story tooth and nail. But I was just wondering, the last time I heard about this was on your show months ago. And I just wondered now what happens or what did happen to all the taxpayers and the City of Kitchener funding money that the symphony got. Is that gone now, or is that in limbo? Where would that be now?
Yeah, my guess would be, John, and it is just a guess, but I feel fairly confident in it, that would have been written off as losses, if you will, and now we're starting with a clean slate.
So all that taxpayers' money is gone?
I would suspect so, yes.
Okay. All right. Well, hopefully they continue, but I'd like to see where the tax dollars go and a benefit to the taxpayer.
Appreciate the call, John, and the thought on that. And this is inevitably what we encounter when we talk about arts and culture in our communities. And you know that I come at this from a position of bias. I'm a huge supporter. I believe that music and theater and all kinds of performance and opportunity enrich our communities. I really do. I think there is, I would connect it to some degree to the conversation we had yesterday about getting high-speed rail into this country, at least on a Windsor to Quebec corridor, for example. There is an argument to be made for public funding and public operation of such a system in the interests of the greater public good. And I believe that's the case when it comes to arts and culture. How much gets invested, et cetera, can be certainly debated. And if it gets invested at all, continues to be debated. I totally get where you're coming from. And some would look at grants to arts organizations as being a waste of money, or they want to see a return on that investment. Again, I believe these sorts of opportunities, all kinds of performance, music, theater, spoken word, you name it, really do enrich us as a community, even if we don't personally avail ourselves of those opportunities on a regular basis or at all. These are important pieces of an overall healthy community, in my opinion. And sure, we can certainly have the conversation about how much gets granted out or where it gets granted out, etc. And some will say flat out, you know what, arts organizations, like any other private enterprise, should survive on their own. If the programming is good enough, if the performance is good enough, then the ticket prices will be such that people will pay enough to continue to sustain the organization. I understand that argument too, but I'm a big believer in investing in arts as part of the greater public good. I can't wait to hear where the symphony goes from here. This is the Mike Farwell Show on 570 News Radio. Probably a good time to remind you that Devin Robertson is our guy on the other side of the glass, a.k.a. DJ Dev on Turntables 1 and 2, spinning all of your favorite Halloween hits through the day. I love this day. I love this holiday. It's not really a holiday, but maybe we should get the day off. We should definitely get the next day off. Nurse our candy hangovers and our sore tummies, right? But I love all things Halloween. I love the horror movies. I love the costumes. I love the music. And we've got you covered here on the show. Tyler sends an email to Mike at 570news.com. His favorite horror film is The Thing. John Carpenter apparently working on a sequel, says Tyler. Is it awful if I've never seen it? It wasn't a genre of movies I paid a lot of attention to. My favorite horror villain, as I mentioned earlier, is Michael Myers from the Halloween franchise. That was my wheelhouse when I was a kid, right? Growing up in the 1980s when all of the slasher flicks were the favorites of the day, Michael Myers became my favorite of those. But when it comes to all-time favorite horror films, it's got to be The Exorcist. I saw that as a young adult. Me and my buddies from college went to see it. It was replayed on the big screen. So we went after school one time to a theater in Cambridge to see it. I can't remember which one, to be honest with you, but doesn't matter. Absolutely freaked me the heck out. And to this day will remain my favorite horror film. And then Pat, I don't know why Pat does this to me. She cheers for the team that shall not be named and is always teasing me about that. And she sends an email to Mike at 570news.com and says, I'm so sorry I'm not able to send you a box of Big Turks. Like, What have I ever done to Pat except cheer for the Toronto Maple Leafs, I suppose. But as you probably know, Big Turks, I believe, are the worst chocolate bar slash candy ever invented. It's terrible stuff. I walked into the radio station this morning and Josh Piercy, who was handling morning traffic for us on All News Mornings, extended the bowl of candy from the newsroom and said, we've refilled it with all of your favorites. And I looked inside and all there was in the bowl were the Rockets, which are the leftover candies because nobody likes them. That's why everything else got eaten. Piercy hands me a bowl full of Rockets. No love for the talk show host here on Halloween Day. Not a lot of love for Ontario Premier Doug Ford around this $200 rebate check. But are critics attacking him the wrong way? We'll talk about that coming up on the Mike Farwell Show. This is 570 News Radio. pretty exciting, isn't it? That $200 check that the Ontario government, I mean, let's just tell it like it is. Doug Ford's giving you, he's personally, the man is going to give you $200 next year. It's got nothing to do with a likely early election in the province. And it will go to every single Ontarian, even the millionaires. Just ask the opposition parties who are pointing that out to us. And of course, what else could we be doing with all of that money? So go the attacks to date on Ontario Premier Doug Ford over the $200 rebate checks that will be delivered next year. John Malloy is the director at the Center for Public Ethics at Martin Luther University College and joins us for a conversation. John, good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
You've suggested that what Doug Ford has done here is not merely perhaps bribe voters in an early election, but actually laid a trap for his critics. How did he do that?
Well, because the knee-jerk reaction that everyone has, the sort of members of the chattering class, and I guess I'm a card-carrying member of that, is to immediately say, oh my gosh, oh heavens, giving money directly to ordinary Ontarians, what a horrible idea. With all the need out there, we need to be hiring doctors and nurses and dealing with a whole range of issues. We need to spend that money in better ways. This is awful. And they kind of go on this. And you saw it yesterday, particularly, I think, and I'm not trying to be overly partisan, but Merritt Stiles, leader of the opposition, and she's been saying this. A lot of columnists have been saying this. You saw tweets in response to the $200 move. It's all about how this money could be better spent by the government in other areas instead of giving it to ordinary Ontarians.
So how would you approach this rebate then? What would you do as a critic? Because you're a former Liberal cabinet minister, after all. How would you be attacking the government on this?
Well, the first thing is that I would, you know, turn off everything and close the door and sit there and say, yes, they should be spending it on health care, on education, on a whole variety of areas. And once I got that out of my system, I'd start to recognize that that's not actually the way a lot of people think. And I'm not being overly critical. There's a lot of people out there that don't have much use for government. They don't trust government. And every time they hear a politician talk about how much they've invested in hospitals, for example, they recall the fact that they were recently in a hospital and had to wait 7 or 8 hours in an emergency room, or the fact that they can't get a family doctor. I mean, the fact is what people want, a lot of people, when it comes to government, is something tangible. Unless it's tangible, unless they can feel it in their hands, they're very mistrustful of government. And so that $200 is actually it's brilliant politically in the part of Doug Ford, because there's a whole bunch of people out there who are just angry with government in general. They don't trust it. And all of a sudden they're going to have $200 in their pocket to buy a tank of gas and some groceries. And they're going to think, you know what? I don't really, you know, like government. I may not like what Doug Ford's doing, but he seems to be the only one that cares about me. So I think you got to recognize that if you're an opposition politician, and as frustrating as it is, because you'd like to talk about all the wonderful programs that are out there, you have to recognize it. So that's point one. And point two, though, is these same people that are mistrustful of government, they also worry a lot about fairness. And I think, you know, I've knocked on thousands of doors, I've talked to thousands of constituents, and many of them see government as being in it for the wealthy, you know, tax cuts for the wealthy. We give automakers billions of dollars, but nothing for the little guy. And there's a flaw in what Ford is doing, is because this $200 is going to everyone, which means there's all sorts of rich people out there who are getting the $200. And I think Mike Schreiner has been the most effective, because he keeps talking about Galen Weston, the head of Loblaws. And, you know, God bless Mr. Weston. I'm sure he's a nice person, but his company is the one that charges us expensive groceries. His company is the one that admitted they fixed the price of bread. And yet Galen Weston is getting $200 of your money and my money. And if I was an opposition politician, I would forget every other argument And I would simply say there are millionaires and billionaires in this province who Doug Ford is going to give $200 of your money to. I would buy a billboard. I would film a TV commercial. And, you know, as I say, God bless Mr. Weston, who's doing nothing. But Galen Weston's a wonderful poster child for this. And I think with his salary, he could take it.
You know, now, John, now you got me upset all over again here when I'm thinking about all the millionaires. I mean, look, I probably don't need it myself. Will it put some gas in the car and some food on the table? Sure. But your point is so well taken that even those among us here in Ontario that do need it, could really put $200 to good use, recognize that not all 15, 16 million Ontarians need access to this $200 check.
And I think, you know, and it is, it's about fairness. I mean, what's the Greenbelt scandal about? A bunch of rich developers getting richer. And whether you're appreciative of the efforts by both the federal and provincial government to bring electric vehicles here. I mean, we gave multinational corporations billions and billions of dollars. I think people get angry. People get angry at government because they don't see results, and people get angry at government because they're quick to offer billions of dollars to multinational companies, but not a lot for the little guy. And Doug Ford realizes that. You know what? I have huge respect for his political antennae, whatever, I guess, that he understands that. And you know what? Part of it is on him. Part of it is on him that he's run a government that no one really trusts. He's run a government in such a way that no one trusts government. I mean, he's answerable for that. But at the end of the day, he's taking advantage of it by saying, you know what? You may not believe government can do much for you, but look down. You've got $200 in your hand. You're going to have a check that says pay to the order of John Molloy, $200. At least there's one tangible thing that Doug Ford has done. I mean, it's brilliant. And the opposition are falling into the trap of saying, no, it should be invested here in programs, blah, blah, blah. I'm tuning that out while I go cash my check. But the one thing that I'm not going to tune out is the idea that Galen Weston's also getting $200. And sorry again to Mr. Weston for vilifying him so much. I'm sure we can come up. Mitch Marner's going to get $200. You know, depending how the Leafs are doing that week, maybe that'll get under people's skin.
Another excellent example and something for us to think about for sure. John, always appreciate your time. Thanks for being here this morning.
Thank you, Mike.
John Molloy is the director at the Center for Public Ethics at Martin Luther University College. Absolutely, the $3 billion from this handout could be put to better/different use. But what about the point that John Molloy makes? What about the fact that it's not just you getting the $200, it's also the millionaires in this province who have filed their taxes in this province, a la Galen Weston, a la Mitch Marner and Austin Matthews and John Tavares. I presume they do file their taxes here. Your thoughts on the $200 rebate? I also agree with John. Love them or lump them, it's incredibly smart politicking from Doug Ford. What do you make of the $200 rebate? Let me know on the Mike Farwell Show. This is 570 News Radio and Rogers TV.
God bless Mr. Weston. I'm sure he's a nice person, but his company is the one that charges us expensive groceries. His company is the one that admitted they fixed the price of bread, and yet Galen Weston is getting $200 of your money and my money. And if I was an opposition politician, I would forget every other argument, and I would simply say there are millionaires and billionaires in this province who Doug Ford is going to give $200 of your money to.
John Molloy is the director of the Center for Public Ethics at Martin Luther University College. He says, yeah, we could make the argument that the $3 billion or so being spent on this $200 rebate for every Ontarian could be spent elsewhere, better spent elsewhere. Most of us will agree on that. But John says, what about this? Every Ontarian, including the millionaires and billionaires, are going to get the rebate as well. What's your take on the $200? 519-570-2545, star 570, 1-800-570-5715. Michael, good morning.
Good morning. I was reflecting that the $200 that I am going to receive reflects the amount of PST that I spent on about $3,000. In my mind, a millionaire probably spends a lot more money than I do that he pays PST on in a month. So really, this tax seems to me to be exactly like the carbon tax. We pay it, and then I get a refund. In my case, I'm quite happy with the carbon tax and taking my refund that I have calculated pays more than I pay out back. And the richer people that spend more money on carbon items, well, they don't get as much money back. So it does ferret out to the rich people and the less people. I have a household income of under $60,000 in that way. So I think that the argument that it is unreasonable to give $200 to a rich person doesn't make any sense to me when it is fair that they only get $200 and spent so much more.
It's an interesting way to look at it, Michael. I'm recalling a conversation from earlier this morning already. Numbers never lie and liars never number. No, wait. Figures never lie and liars never figure. Something like that. Kevin, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Mike. Well, I 100% agree with Dr. Malloy what he was saying. And I believe that this kind of refunds should be targeted for a people under a certain amount of income. Like you want to, same as the dental program. You know, the dental program that we were talking about in the news today is only targeted towards the people who are making under, $190,000 a year, you know. So I think this kind of refund should be reflecting for the people under a certain amount. And then it shouldn't be going to the people who are making a lot of money. And besides all the celebrities, I think we forgot to say Justin Bieber is also going to get $200.
All right, Kevin. He can put it into that Puss Lynch mansion he shares with Haley. Is that her name? The guy that just got off from the gun charge. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, Justin and Haley. Haley, I'm sure of. I just can't remember. I'm blanking. Doesn't matter. Justin Bieber gets the $200 too. Paul, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I have to agree with your other caller who said everybody should get it, including the millionaires, because they paid into it. What's interesting is when I first heard about it, it was on the radio, it said every taxpayer in Ontario is going to get $200, right? And then I thought to myself, well, that's interesting, because it's probably about 40% of people here that have never, in Ontario, that have never paid personal income tax, right? So, but they're getting the $200 like everybody else. But one thing I do have to say, both my wife are working. We're not well off, but I mean, we're fairly well off. And, you know, I would challenge anybody that, you know, does not need the $200 if it's not a necessity to them, donate it to the food bank, because that's what we're doing with our $200, right? I can get by without it. But I do appreciate the fact that Doug Ford is trying to put money in our hands. And I think that's, you know, with those politicians saying, oh, well, the money could be better spent this, better spent there. Like, no. I know how to spend my money better than the government does, right? And that's why it's good that. And I appreciate Doug Ford also taking away the license plate renewals, because my family has 5 cars. So that's a $600 savings right there every year for us in our pocket, right? And that's what our politicians should be doing, is trying to get as much money back to the people as possible and let them spend it themselves. They know what to do with that money. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. I appreciate it. The libertarian in me does appreciate that piece of it. It's my money that you collected from me. Like, can I please determine where I would like to allocate that money? We could say, you know, the $3 billion sum could be spent better on hospitals, this, that, the other thing. But if I want to donate it to the food bank now, I've got $200 more to donate to the food bank. The increasing size of my inner libertarian can get behind that. Baldwin, Haley Baldwin. Right, Alec Baldwin, the Baldwin brothers. That's Justin Bieber's wife, I think. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll keep talking about this. I got Mary on the line, and if you think that Doug Ford is a conservative, at least in the fiscal sense, I've got some numbers that might blow your mind a little bit. It's more than just this $3 billion that he has found ways to allocate elsewhere. We'll talk about it as we continue our conversation about this $200 rebate today. This is the Mike Farwell Show, 570 News Radio and Rogers TV. continue our conversation about that $200 rebate check. You're going to be getting directly from Doug Ford next year. He's good at the politicking. Let's go back to the phones. Mary, what do you think of your check?
I think it's ridiculous. I think it's absolutely balmy.
Why?
Well, we spend at least $1 billion servicing our debt. Why doesn't he bring down the debt with that money?
Great question.
And that would help everybody out. Now, how are they giving these out? Is it by, I had heard, anybody that has put in a income tax?
Correct. So you'll just get a little direct deposit.
Yeah, but okay. But they say every man, woman, and child. Children don't put in a tax report.
That's a very good point. I guess they must know from your tax forms, right? I don't know.
Well, no, ridiculous. And the other thing is, you have to have an address, don't you?
One would assume.
Or a bank.
Sure.
Well, all these homeless people, tent people, who could really use it, they have no address.
That's true.
Well, that to me, and then Galen West and the billionaires, I don't agree with that first guy. I think it's ridiculous. Put it where it really helps.
That's a great point, Mary. Put it where it really helps. And I just want to share with you some figures from today's Globe and Mail, which points out, along with this $3 billion, there's also the $1 billion from the license plate sticker removal, the removal of that fee, and then another $7 billion plus on electricity rebates. So the Globe has totaled up some $12 billion, which could have been used for a variety of other things, like cutting corporate taxes in half, or, you know, cutting personal income taxes, etc., raising the basic deduction and delivering a permanent tax benefit to all Ontarians. That's what a typically fiscally conservative government could do with this kind of money, but instead, this particular conservative government is just handing it all back. $12 billion worth. This is the Mike Farwell Show, 570 News Radio and Rogers TV.
Ooka chaka, ooka, ooka, ooka chaka, ooka, ooka, ooka chaka, ooka, ooka, ooka chaka, ooka, ooka, ooka.
I can't stop this feeling deep inside of me. Girl, you just don't realize what you do to me. When you hold me in your arms so tight, you let me know everything's alright. I'm hooked on a feeling.
Well, that music can only mean one thing. It's time for our friend Gary Chaka. Gary Chaka, who joins us on Thursday mornings at 10:30 to bring his Living Retired Humor column to our show. You can find that column for yourself, by the way, online, livingretired.press. While you're there, sign up for the weekly newsletter. It will be delivered directly into your inbox. And who doesn't need something funny in their inbox instead of all that junk mail we get and the memos from the boss? Mr. Chalk, well, you don't get memos from the boss anymore, do you, Mr. Living Retired?
No. My wife doesn't need to send a memo. She just comes to me and says what I'm going to do.
The honey-do list is never-ending.
You're right. Even on Halloween, I probably have things to do today.
Well, the thing you have to do is not eat the candy before the kids come later, Gary.
Well, yeah, you're onto that. You know, it's interesting, though, because I look at what the kids play on Halloween for games. I don't think they bob for apples anymore, do they?
Oh, my goodness. That's an old school tradition for sure.
What I remember talking about old school, Mike, is, did you ever play Red Rover?
Oh, my goodness. Red Rover. And they always called Mikey over because he could never break through the barrier on the other side, the tiny guy that I was.
Well, that's me, too. You know, everybody lined up in these lines opposite each other. They'd hold hands. And the first one was Red Rover. We call Gary over. And with that, I don't know, the message never sunk in. I ran like a maniac right into their collective arms of everybody on the other team. And, of course, I never broke it. The only thing I did was break a finger or something because I was always so being beat up. I was small, too. The other game was Leapfrog.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And these were neighborhood games that we played. You know, we'd be out on the street in July at 7:30, 8 o'clock at night on the street. And everybody formed two lines. You picked your partner, and then you squatted down on the ground. And on the other person, their objective was to run full tilt, press their arms against the back of the person laying down, which basically was a pile drive, and put them down into the sidewalk. Those were the neighborhood games I remember.
You know, you talk about being outside on a July night around 7:30 or 8 o'clock. Do you know what we did? And I think back on it, different times, I suppose, but hide and seek was the big one. And we did not contain ourselves to the properties of the people playing the game. We were all over the neighborhood. And if the neighbors cared, they didn't say so.
I think it was a different time. It was sort of the neighborhood was the family, right? Everybody sort of looked out for everybody else.
Absolutely.
Then there's the games, Mike, that we played at family reunions. We used to have the Chalk Family Picnic Reunion every year, and we'd get all the aunts and uncles and cousins and everybody gathered at some big park. They booked the pavilion, and everybody brought some food. The thing was, the most popular food was either potato salad or deviled eggs. And I think they picked those because the main ingredients was mayonnaise, which was the perfect ingredient for sitting your bowl of food out in the hot sun.
Right? I never thought of it that way, but let me tell you, I am a deviled eggs devil. Don't put them near me. I will eat them all.
Well, I can have a few, but not that many. Anyways, I that's what I remember. And then we'd play games at those picnics, and that involved eggs. I don't know what it was with our family picnic and eggs. We had the egg toss, and that's where you sort of stood opposite somebody and threw the egg back and forth. And the object was obviously to catch it and not have the egg break.
Yeah, there's nothing bad that can come of that, right? If you thought mayonnaise in the summer sun was bad, how about the egg yolk dripping down your forearms?
Or if you want something worse to come bad with egg, how about the egg and spoon race?
Yes, I love that one.
Yeah, you put a spoon in your mouth, put the egg on it, then you started running. What could possibly go wrong?
We just didn't know any better, Gary. We were fearless.
My gosh. You know, it was the same outcome, broken eggs and broken teeth.
There you go.
We look forward to next year and doing it once again.
Keep the dentists in business.
That's what it was. Another game that was sort of, it wasn't dangerous. It was dangerous to my neighbors, really. My sister Diane and I, we played croquet. Did you ever play that?
I loved croquet. Give me a wooden mallet to smack something with, I'm in.
That's it. We had those round wooden balls with the wood mallet and the little hoop that you hit the thing through. We had a version, my sister and I, we called it smack and smash. And that's where you had the opportunity to put your ball against your opponent's ball. Then you smack the bejeebers out of it. That was the smack. Inevitably, though, I'd smack my sister's croquet ball so hard, so far, it would scoot across the yard into the neighbors and smash through one of their basement windows.
Then you had to do some chores or whatever to pay for the broken window, right?
But I was used to that because I used to always throw a baseball against the back of our house, which was a brick house. And for a baseball, I used a golf ball.
Oh, gosh.
And inevitably, my father would be in the basement, and I'd throw the ball, and I'd miss the wall, and I'd drive it right through the window.
You know, you get me thinking back when you talk croquet especially, Gary. We had a cottage, a family cottage in Hanover with a lot of property. And so it was perfect for setting up a really intricate croquet area, right? To play in. And we also had lawn darts up there. And you know what? There was a lawn dart incident, but we survived, Gary. I feel bad for kids that can't use lawn darts anymore.
Well, lawn darts, there's a precursor to lawn darts, which my sister and I also got into, and this is probably something we could talk about, which is the fact that when you were, 8, 9 years old, did your parents buy an indoor dart set?
You know what? We never. My buddies had one. My best friend growing up. So we didn't have one at home, but my buddy had one.
Oh, no, we had one. I think we were about 8 years old or so, and my parents got this set, and it was Christmas Day, and we set it up in against the wall in the laundry room. Mom and Dad went upstairs to work on the Christmas dinner. Diane and I, we played. Well, what we did was recklessly hurl razor-sharp darts. Again, what can possibly go wrong?
Absolutely. We're still here talking about it, so absolutely nothing is the answer to that.
Well, not quite, because my sister, she would always bounce the dart off the dartboard or the wall and hit Mom's metal washing machine. And then I would always seem to somehow hit Dad's workbench where he had all the empty baby food jars filled with needles. And it would end up, Diane would scream, "Dad, Gary hit me with a dart again," and then I would scream, "She stabbed me first."
Of course. It was always the other person that did it first. They started it. They
you
started
it.
Oh, from the leapfrogging and the egg races with spoons in our mouths and croquet as kids, the older we get, the more intricate the games become. We'll continue our conversation as we do every Thursday morning at this time with Gary Chalk. He writes the humor column Living Retired, and he joins us here on the Mike Farwell Show, 570 News Radio and Rogers TV. Thursday mornings at this time, we are joined by Gary Chalk. Gary writes the humor column Living Retired, which you will find online at livingretired.press. Gary, we've been talking about the games that we have played, and I feel like the older we get, the more intricate the games become, or maybe it's just more dangerous. I'm not sure.
Well, I think what led to it is because we as children used to always play a game called dodgeball.
Oh, yes.
And I think I still permanently have this red blister on the side of my head as I become an adult from playing dodgeball in the gymnasium. I mean, the objective, you threw this ball at someone on the other team, and if you did it well enough, that entire volleyball or whatever it was would leave the Voight imprint on their face. And that's what I remember from playing it. But then we get to be adults.
Wait a minute. Just let me back up. Sorry.
Yeah, yep.
You know the point was to dodge the ball, Gary.
Well, I could heave it. I just couldn't dodge it.
There you go.
Then the other thing is, I've noticed Living Retired, Mike, is that this obsession that we had with throwing those sharp objects has now come through as adults. I mean, the latest craze now, again, sharp objects, what can go wrong? Indoor axe tossing.
Yes, of course.
Have you done that?
I have, and they combine it with alcohol, Gary.
That's it.
Yes.
And that's what got you there in the first place.
The alcohol?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I can throw an axe anywhere I want, okay? I can't get a craft beer in my basement.
No, that's it. I mean, what's better for people who are living retired than indoor axe throwing? I mean, you know, here you got senior citizens. We're taking pills for high cholesterol, pills for high blood pressure, medication to calm our nerves. Many don't drink after dark because of their decreased eyesight. We hobble around on bum knees. We're complaining about sore hips. That's not enough. Many people have an unexplained tremor in the right hand. So we just hand that person an axe with a Swiss-engineered carbon steel blade.
Yes. Yes, we are.
It's just like, you know, automatically renewing a senior's driver's license at 90. You know, it's just not a pretty picture. And then what I've never done it. But I've heard people who have done it. And they said, you know, Gary, you got to remember, it's in a room. So, the axe doesn't go on forever, which is, you know, I guess one way. But then the other way of looking at it, if it's in a room, it sort of keeps all those flying axes in the air. They start careening off the walls, and it's, you know, it's again, not a pretty picture.
Again, you're supposed to hit the target, Gary, just like those dodgeballs that were always getting you in the face.
Well, there's three rules of axe throwing.
Okay.
Number one, everybody throws their axe all at the same time. Rule two, axe throwers retrieve their axes together. That's a good rule. And rule three, no exceptions. Now, again, do you really expect someone to throw a fellow an axe and to remember those basic rules when they can't remember where they left their iPhone? Right? Can't find their parked car, can't remember to put the toilet seat down, and now with a sharp object in their hand with other people in a confined space, you expect those people to remember those rules. Not going to happen.
Are you an overhead axe thrower, or do you try the underhand method?
I haven't done it, but I hadn't thought about that. I never thought of that.
I know. I've seen people do it both ways. I'm like, this is very interesting. I wonder which way I could master.
Well, I'm not sure I would ever master it, Mike, but I think I'd be an overhead guy because I'd want to be macho. I'd want to really hurl that thing and see it, not stick in the target, but at least bounce off it.
Yeah, it does feel more macho. You're right, to throw it overhead, for sure.
You're right.
Yeah.
You ever played golf and axe throw, back-to-back?
I have been known to throw the occasional golf club. Does that count?
It does, because golfers, there's a lot of similarities. Golfers get angry, they throw their clubs. Axe throwers blow off steam hurling an axe,
It makes perfect sense.
Yes, golfers holler four, axe throwers scream duck. And again, everybody's there drinking. But there is a difference between the two, between golf and axe throwing. When you golf, you bend over to pick up your ball. However, when you're axe throwing, you duck down when your opponent's axe whizzes past your head, right?
When somebody yells four, you find yourself looking around for the ball until it hits you in the head.
I had lots of experience with ducking down, playing indoor darts and lawn darts with my sister.
See, this is the thing. The games that we played as children were merely preparing us for the dumb things we do as adults.
And that's why I think now that one of the most popular games as adults is cornhole. There's no movement. You stand there. You pick up a 2-ounce bag of beans and you throw it at the board at the other end and you have a sip of your drink.
Exactly. And you know what? The bean bags are not sharp in any way, right? No injury can possibly occur.
Well,
okay, good point, Gary, good point. If there's a way, we're going to find it.
That's the truth. The other one, of course, is limbo. I remember doing that as a kid. We'd get down on our back and you'd go a few feet below the bars. Now, as seniors, I start by lying on the ground, and I suck in my stomach and try to roll underneath. And then the hardest part is getting up.
Oh, my gosh. And I never, ever went the way you're supposed to go limbo-wise. I would always lean forward.
Yeah.
I cheated completely at limbo.
It's just one of those silly dances.
Gary, stay out of the treats. Give them to the kids tonight, okay?
Hey, happy Halloween.
Gary Chalk writes the humor column, Living Retired. You'll hear him on the show every Thursday morning at 10:30 to bring the column to life, and you can sign up for it online at livingretired.press. This is the Mike Farwell Show on 570 News Radio and Rogers TV. Tell me the music alone doesn't give you a little bit of a chill, at least a teeny weeny little bit. And as mild as it is today, a little dull and gray out there for Halloween. This, of course, the theme music from the horror franchise Halloween. Some good stuff from John Carpenter. And Michael Myers, my absolute favorite Halloween character. In fact, my coworker, Brady, from the Brady and Tara morning show over on Chime 96.7, Brady was dressed up as Michael Myers today. Full-on mask, messy hair. It was fantastic. Looked great. Creeps me out, but looked great. As I think back, that was one of the ways that we were entertained by screens when I was a kid. I watched a lot of movies. I did. I spent some time Saturday morning cartoons, right? In front of the TV. I'm thinking of this because we just talked to Gary Chalk, the weekly segment Living Retired from Gary's humor column that he writes, but thinking back on the games that we played as kids, and it just makes me think of all of the things that we did that did not involve a screen, for how long we would be entertained just outdoors playing hide and seek. My buddy and I used to play catch. We'd just throw the baseball back and forth so many times. Another buddy of mine and I would go over to the elementary school and shag fly balls and just a lot of outdoor time and a lot of time away from screens. But of course, we didn't have the same number of screens, right? And we didn't have so much at our disposal in the palm of our hands. But I still think that if we as parents didn't allow for so much screen time, we'd be surprised to find out how entertained kids actually are. And speaking of parents and how we deal with our kids, what do we do when our kid doesn't get that award they were hoping for at school, or they don't win the game that they were playing with the team that they have signed up to play with? A little bit of adversity can be a good thing, can't it, in our kids' lives? We'll talk about that coming up on the Mike Farwell Show this morning. This is 570 News Radio and Rogers TV. Every once in a while, we'll fall into the whole, you know, when I was a kid thing. And we get a little bit frustrated at times when we think about, for example, organized sports where the score is not kept so that there's not really a winner of a game and, by extension, a loser of the game. We just want the play to occur. We don't tend to hold children back as they move through their academic lives anymore. Heaven forbid somebody not succeed and move on successfully to the next grade, right? And a lot of this is attached to our ideas as the elders, as the parents, to wrap our arms around our young ones and say, we don't want you to face adversity, or we want to help to mitigate the impacts of that adversity. Well, what is research telling us about this? And is there, in fact, an upside to adversity, to every once in a while recognizing that you weren't successful and that's okay? Julia Yates is a PhD candidate in health promotion at Western University and joins us to talk about this. And I think one of the things that is important for us to make distinct when we're having this conversation is the difference between the adversity, let's say, of losing a game that you played against another team and real deep childhood traumas, for example, that can lead to far different outcomes and have a far different impact. So let's just start, Julia, if we can, when we're talking about adversity in this case, what is it that we're talking about?
Yeah, so adversity in general is quite broad, and really they're just any circumstances or events that might threaten a child's physical or psychological well-being. So that's sort of, broadly speaking, adversity. When we think about trauma, a traumatic experience can happen after exposure to sort of that general adversity, but it's not necessarily going to happen. What we know about traumatization and traumatic experiences is those are sort of folded into our understanding of adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, which are the specific set of circumstances. So those are those severely, particularly severe subset of adversities, those really intense things that could happen to children, including things like abuse, neglect, or having a death in their immediate family.
And I can't help but wonder, Julia, if this connection that we sometimes see between the adversity and the much deeper traumatic experiences is what has led us to a place where I feel sometimes we think that any adversity is a bad thing.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. So obviously those particularly traumatic experiences that do lead to or can lead to ACE-related disorders, things like PTSD or depression, those are obviously not the types of adversity that we want children to be exposed to. But what we're sort of talking about with this general adversity that people, I think, then, like you said, lead to them sort of wanting to have children be sort of protected from adversity at all times, is that going through these small bouts of sort of the more positive side of adversity, when children are supported by their environments, they can actually learn to sort of regulate the stress response, and that turns into them having these sort of coping abilities and self-regulation abilities that allow them to cope when smaller things happen in life. So things like losing at their sports game, or perhaps not winning that academic award that they wanted, those types of things. If they go through smaller adversities in a supportive environment, they'll actually be better able to cope, and those won't feel earth-shattering to them.
So what is happening in those supportive environments that would help a child build this resilience from those small bouts of adversity you just described?
Yeah, so this looks like things like having a supportive parental network in place. So having those people when you do face a stressful experience that can help to bring you back, because obviously as children you don't have those tools, or you might not have those tools yet. You need those people in place. When we think about supportive environments, that also looks like a lot of conditions that tend to be out of children's control. So things like having sort of a stable income, stable housing, having parents with flexible employers so that they can and are able to sort of support you in your times of need, or be there for you in those big events. So environmental in terms of sort of those social structures in place, but also your immediate environment that you're being raised in, or you know, being educated in, those types of things.
What do we know about the impact that adversity has on children?
Yeah, so in terms of like ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, those types of adversities, those worst types of adversities are more severe, can lead to sort of maladaptation, negative psychosocial experiences or impacts. However, in these sort of small bouts of general adversity, we know that children can develop adaptive skills and self-regulation abilities. This can then contribute to their resilience. We also know that sort of bouncing back from something that children might feel is a quote-unquote failure for themselves, so again, something like losing a sports game that they were really wanting to win, can actually help them to develop a growth mindset. And so this sort of lets them learn from that, what they feel is failure. And this can help build their teamwork skills, their interpersonal skills, their ability to have positive coping mechanisms instead of sort of that maladaptive coping mechanisms that we sometimes see when children don't have enough experience dealing with adversity.
I certainly haven't done the depth of research that you have, Julia, but I would assume that we learn that adversity does not affect all children equally. There must be factors at play that, you know, make it more difficult for some, for example.
Yes, certainly that is the case. And so we know that there are a number of social factors that impact their sort of ability to bounce back and deal with adversity. Things like gender, race, and family socioeconomic status are sort of three that have been studied that time and time again we have found. So for example, in a study of about 45,000 children that were aged 6 to 17, it found that white and socioeconomically advantaged families are going to be more likely and more able to sort of maintain their levels of resilience in the face of adversity. And that really leads to those sort of social determinants of health that we talk about. So things like gender and race and socioeconomic status are going to inherently impact your health, because they are those social determinants of health. We also saw during COVID the same sort of trends that we had seen pre-COVID, but sort of amplified. So we conducted a scoping review of the literature during COVID, and we found that it kind of created this perfect storm for negative socioeconomic impacts among families. So if they did have those sort of resilience-promoting environments in place, again, things like financial support, flexible employers, job security, those were really essential to families' abilities to support their children through, obviously, the high levels of adversity that were occurring at the time. And when those were in place, they could sort of help their children to develop positive coping mechanisms. Now, the opposite was also true. So families who didn't have access to those socioeconomic prerequisites for their resilience faced sort of, again, that perfect storm of negative impacts. So they were just heightened during that time.
What are the takeaways here, Julia? I have to think that as parents, for example, the way that we view failures or, you know, not making a sports team or not getting that award at school, you know, and we look at this adversity as a failure might be, you know, be projected onto our children, for example. What should we take away from this?
Yeah, so we know that the way that parents perceive a child's failure is going to directly impact how the child responds to that. So time and time again, we see that children adopt the same mindset as their parents. So if parents are seeing a failure as a sort of negative thing, then children will feel the same way. So I think it's really important for parents to sort of perceive this failure as an opportunity for their child to grow. And it obviously is very difficult to do so, but when we do that, we're actually contributing to their lifelong ability to adapt to adversity. So it's not that they are going to learn this at 5 and then it's going to completely disappear by 7. When we teach them these skills at that young age, they're actually going to have those sort of in their tool belt for the rest of their life, which has positive health and psychosocial impacts of those sort of positive coping mechanisms. So it really is allowing them this tool to impact them positively for the remainder of their life.
It's very interesting research, and I really appreciate you making time on the show today to talk with us about it. Julia, yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Julia Yates is a PhD candidate in health promotion at Western University, sharing with us some research that she is working on that demonstrates that children learn resilience from coping with difficulties. There is an upside to adversity. And I know what we're talking about here is adversity on a smaller scale or to a lesser degree. We're not getting into deep-seated trauma that comes from abuse, neglect, etc. But it is okay that sometimes you play a game and you don't win, right? I don't know who needs to hear this, but I certainly found it refreshing because it seems to me to be counter to what is generally accepted these days when it comes to adversity for our kids, right? We want to, it's that whole idea of bubble wrapping, which I think is a mistake. It's just me sitting over here. Maybe you heard it differently, or, you know, maybe we're of like mind on this, right? A little bit of adversity. Let's be there and provide the supportive environment for our children to go through those difficulties and kind of figure it out for themselves, come out the other side with our support. What is the old saying, that life is not a bed of roses or a bowl of cherries? Sometimes you just end up with the pits, right? This is the Mike Farwell Show on 570 News Radio and Rogers TV.
When children are supported by their environments, they can actually learn to sort of regulate the stress response. And that turns into them having these coping abilities and self-regulation abilities that allow them to cope when smaller things happen in life, losing at their sports game or perhaps not winning that academic award that they wanted. If they go through smaller adversities in a supportive environment, they'll actually be better able to cope, and those won't feel earth-shattering to them.
Am I the only one who thinks that message doesn't resonate as much as it used to? I feel as though we have entered an era. Maybe we're exiting the era. I don't know. But I certainly feel as though we're in a place where generally we have been trying to shelter our youth from those incidents of adversity, so that they are protected. They don't have to endure what we endured. And heaven forbid, you know, they don't win. You know, it's the whole participation ribbon idea here, right? That there is no clear-cut winner and or loser. There's no podium finish. Everybody just gets the ribbon for participation. You get together for a soccer game, organized. You signed up for it through Kitchener Minor Soccer, for example, and then you go out there and you kick the ball around, and sometimes the ball goes in the other net, whatever, and at the end of the night, you just have your orange slices and you go home. That's Julia Yates, a PhD candidate in health promotion at Western University, joining us to talk about her research around what we learn, particularly
our children the resilience that is gained from coping with difficulties. There is an upside to those little adversities in life. We're not talking about the heavy traumas here that can have long-lasting and deep-seated psychological impacts. And I think sometimes we kind of conflated the two, right? A loss in a soccer game or the inability to achieve an academic award is far different than what happens when somebody is growing up in an abusive environment, for example. And some of those smaller bouts of adversity, as Julia Yates, our guest, put them, can actually be good for developing those necessary coping skills. Because, you know, someday when our children grow up and become young adults and they exit their academic careers and get into the workforce, they might not start out at the top. Somebody's going to be kind of above them on that corporate chain, if you will. Let's go to the phones, hear from you. Rick, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Mike. Hope you're having a good day.
I am, thanks. How about you?
Every day is a good day.
Attaboy.
Hey, listen, I think we're just coddling the kids too much. Read an article recently about, it was down to a gal in San Francisco, and I had to agree with a lot of what she was saying. A lot of parents are, I didn't hear the term before, are helicoptering their kids, you know, like standing over them, protecting them from absolutely everything. And then your friend there that in retirement mentioned the games that we played as kids. And, you know, like getting hurt was part of the big picture. It taught you what you could get away with and what you can't get away with. And I think the expectations that parents are putting on kids to be something maybe they never were is also complicating their lives. I'll just use a personal experience. My father passed away like a week after my 13th birthday. My mom and I had a younger brother who was 11, and my mom had to go work at a factory. There was no food bank. There was no welfare. There was no safety net. We didn't know what we didn't have because, you know, the chicken was boiled twice and then went on a plate beside some potatoes, and our expectations were completely different. Being picked for, you know, how you'd line up 10 kids to play baseball or 12, I was always the last one picked. I mean, it was just a fact of life. I wasn't that good at it. I just had to work harder at it. And I just think we're coddling the kids too much.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, Rick. And I think some of those social safety nets are critically important for those who are in deeper need. But I can certainly relate to being the last one picked when it came to sports at school. I can relate to a lot of what Rick's talking about there. And you know, a scraped knee, a bloody nose, even the occasional broken bone. It's all part of growing up as kids learn what the boundaries are. This is the Mike Farwell Show on 570 News Radio and Rogers TV. Well, Clinton just had to go there via email to Mike at 570news.com. Speaking of adversity, he writes, I think Leafs fans know adversity the best since we've been watching them not win the Stanley Cup for 57 years. I can relate, Clinton. I've been watching them not win the Stanley Cup my entire life. So, yeah, I know that you don't always get to win, but then you get back out there and you try again next year, right? Thanks for the email. I got to get you to the 570 News Center for an update. And then this is Halloween. I am certain that you have had some sort of paranormal, unexplained experience. And I want to hear those stories on the flip side coming up on the Mike Farwell Show. 570 News Radio and Rogers TV.
My eyes beheld an eerie sight, for my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was
graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It got on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
Ah, it is the day for all things spooky, perhaps even unexplained. Thursday mornings at this time, we, of course, do The Flip Side, which is our opportunity to hear your stories about a given topic. We make it a lighter side of things based on some of the heavier topics we discuss. But today it might get a little bit spooky. I want to know, because I know this has happened to you. I'm sure that it has. And I would love to hear your story of your paranormal or unexplained experience. 'Tis Halloween, after all. Michael even sent an email the other day because he knew he wasn't going to be able to listen to this segment and participate in it. So he wrote via email to Mike at 570news.com. A few years ago, I was doing laundry and I had put my clothes in the dryer. I went upstairs to shower, and when I came back down, my clothes were laid out like the first day of school. No one else was home at the time, so I have no idea. All I did was say thanks when I grabbed my clothes and ran out as fast as possible. I mean, I'll take Michael at his word. He's home alone. He puts the clothes in the dryer. He goes to take a shower and he finds his clothes later neatly folded and laid out like the first day of school. It reminds me of a buddy's uncle who told the story, and he was as serious as a heart attack when he did, about a place that he used to live. And one day from upstairs, there came a sound as if there was walking around or the TV was on, and he was home alone. And so he would go upstairs, and sure enough, he found the TV turned on. So he would turn off the TV and go back downstairs and mind his own business until later the TV would be on again. And this happened on a consistent basis. So one day what he decided to do was rearrange that particular room so that the setup of it was different. And lo and behold, he came back home and found that the setup had been returned to its original state. The TV was back where it had been before he moved it, and the TV was once again turned on. Somebody, something living upstairs preferred to have it a certain way. I don't know, but I just got a chill in relaying the story again. And this is stuff that is inexplicable, but it does happen. I'm sure you have had some sort of encounter with something that you could not quite explain, or you believed to be someone who was dearly departed. I haven't the foggiest, but I do know this much. I believe in spirits that exist somewhere in the in-between, between where we are as living and what we believe to be comes after we are done living. Surely there are things in that vast space in the middle, right? And maybe, just maybe, you have encountered them at one time. 519-570-2545, star 570, 1-800-570-5715. Mayor Jake is with us on the flip side. Mayor Jake, good morning.
Mike, how are you now?
I'm good, and you?
I'm not so bad. So I got, I'll try to keep this one fast. I got two, but I'm going to see what I got for time. So when I was not younger, but when I used to work for the city of Brampton, I used to teach music lessons, guitar, bass, drums, whatever they had me do. There's a building called Central Public School that's right downtown, and they transformed that school into an arts facility, so arts and music and all that stuff. So it's been around before World War One, and I've heard stories from other workers that they've seen things, they've heard things, but you're kind of like, okay, you know, that's all, like, you know, that's all nonsense. So after one of my shifts, I was putting my guitar away, and I was bent over, I was putting it back in its case, and I looked between my feet. I just, like, under my feet, and I see a pair of shoes and somebody standing behind me. And when somebody's standing that close, you kind of turn around and go, hey, what are you doing? And there was nobody there. And when I got home, I took my guitar out to fiddle around with it, and the guitar was so badly out of tune, Mike, that it was, like, down, like a full step down. And my guitar never does that. I always keep really good care of it, and there's no explanation for it other than that had been the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
Another pair of feet directly behind you, but nobody there.
Polished. Like I could see my reflection in these shoes. They were so polished. And the dress pants. And when I went to go look, there was nobody there. And if I never went back to the school. They've asked me to go back. Well, not like this was years ago now, but they were asking me to go back. Like, no, I'm not going back. I'm too scared. There's no way. There's not enough money in the world that you guys could pay me to go back there, because either that guy will steal my guitar or he'll like steal me into another dimension. I'm not doing that.
I love how it's going to get you. Yeah, you're going to end up stolen into another dimension. I love that.
That's right. And I just can't, you know what? People need their Mayor Jake, so.
We do need our Mayor Jake. We do.
That's right.
Mayor Jake, appreciate the story.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling in. Can you imagine? I mean, first of all, I can't even imagine bending over to the point I could see between my feet, because I am as inflexible as they come. I'm open-minded, but I'm inflexible. Some might say stubborn. I just mean I can't touch my toes. But as you're leaning down to put away that guitar, through your own legs, you see another pair of feet. But when you turn around, nobody is there. Look, I believe that these sorts of things happen at, Galt Collegiate Institute. Anyone with that century-old building and how haunted it must be? In fact, we had a guest on the show earlier this week that talked about the alleged spirits that haunt the halls of GCI. And when the light is behind you and you're walking down that hallway, you can see another shadow walking with you. Hence the spirit. I went to a creepy old high school with a bunch of creepy old teachers at St. Jerome's, didn't I? I never saw anything haunted there that I can at least say with any certainty. The closest experience I had, other than the one I shared from my buddy's uncle, and that still gives me a chill to this day, because he had no reason. Like, he wasn't just trying to, you know, get a rise out of us as kids or anything like that. He was telling a legit story about something unexplained that used to be happening in the apartment where he lived. Somebody upstairs or something upstairs continued to either turn on the television or rearrange the furniture. Closest thing for me, I was living in, it was actually my first apartment, downtown Kitchener. Older house, had the upstairs, and I was sitting alone in the living room watching TV. And I could swear as the day is long that I could hear breathing right over my shoulder. Like, I was positive. It was so audible that I'll bet you I could have felt it on my neck. It was there. I felt it. I was sure of it. And it was a little bit unsettling, like, because I knew I was, well, obviously I'm by myself. The couch is up against the wall, but I can hear this behind me. I'm like, what is going on? So I tapped the wall, and then I heard a little bit of a scurry on the other side of the wall. And the breathing was further down to the other end of the couch. And then after a minute or two, it would come back and it would be right near me. But I when I think back on that, I think it was all in my head. Because it only happened that one time. And I'm like, no, I'm just imagining things. So I really don't put a lot of stock in that. But I remember it happening. It was nothing, though, like the repeated television being on and furniture being rearranged. These things do happen because there are spirits out there, right? Glenn, good morning. What's your story?
Hi, good morning. So I'm just going to make this quick because I'm a healthcare worker and I'm going to go in a couple of minutes.
Okay.
So I was walking from my aunt's house to my grandmother's house, probably around 9:30 in the night. And so I was walking and I fold my arms together and walking. And then I just see my hands go up in the air.
Wait.
And you know what I do? I just run, man. I open the door fast and I go straight in. I run. And from that day until today, I remember.
Now, wait, did you see, like, your shadow, your arms were up in the air? What did you see up in the air?
My hands just go up in the air and they were folded. my arms were folded. I'm walking, and I fold them, right? You know, like when you stand up and you just fold your arms and
yes.
stand up like that?
So you're,
I was walking.
So your arms right. just went up in the air by, like, you didn't do it, you're saying?
I didn't do it. I did not do it, and my arms just go right up in the air. And, oh, my goodness, I run.
Amazing.
That was scary.
It was scary. Okay, Glenn, run back to work.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. Thank you for being one of our healthcare workers, too. You're important. And just imagine that. You're walking along, minding your own business. All of a sudden, your arms are in the air. You didn't put them there. Maybe you thought you heard somebody say, stop, or my mom will shoot, or something like that. We'll take a break. Come back with more of your stories on the flip side this morning. Your experiences with the paranormal, your encounters with the unexplained. We want to hear about it on the Mike Farwell Show this Halloween morning. 570 News Radio and Rogers TV. See, this is the thing. Somebody is always watching you. And I'm not talking about the photo radar cameras or all of the other surveillance cameras you pass on any given day. I'm talking about those spirits who are in the in-between, right? You know that they're there. I know that they're there. In fact, there's somebody here. Well, no, this building's too new. This studio's too fancy. They don't want anything to do with this, right? Give it another 100 years and maybe, I'll tell you what, I'm going to make this commitment to you, okay? When they roll my fat, tired old bones out of here for the last time, kicking and screaming, I'm going to haunt the hell out of this studio after I'm gone. The ghost of Farwell will haunt 570 for the rest of its existence. We want to hear this morning, because it is Halloween after all, about your experience with the paranormal, your encounter with the unexplained. Could be just walking down the street as Glenn was, and all of a sudden your arms, which had been folded in front of you, are up in the air. Could be, as Mayor Jake told us, finishing up a music lesson, putting away your guitar, and as you're bending down and you see between your own legs another pair of shoes, highly polished, the pants to go with them. Somebody's standing that close behind you, and then you turn around and nobody is there. Or it could be like my buddy's uncle, who rented a place, and upstairs in that place, something, not somebody, because there was never a somebody, but something kept turning on the TV or rearranging the furniture in the TV room. It wasn't him. What's your paranormal experience? 519-570-2545, star 570, 1-800-570-5715. Connor, what's your story?
Oh, I just, by the way, pleasure talking to you, Mike. Longtime listener. I've been listening to you every day for the past few years.
Oh, thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
Not a problem. I wanted to talk about a house that I used to own in the Loretto, Ontario area. It was built back in the 1890s, and I didn't realize until after I had bought the house that it was originally built as a hotel. It was called the Dominion Inn. And it was more like a bar. And every night after dark, if there was nobody in the upstairs, you could hear old-time country folk music start playing. And one part of the house that I had actually made an effort to keep in its original condition was the flooring in the upstairs, because you could see the spur marks on the dance floor. Like, it was that old.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so I ended up putting a coating on it to protect that so I could always see that, but it would be about 2-3 times a week after dark. You'd hear this old country folk music starting up, and you could hear people. It sounded like they were line dancing upstairs. But you'd go up there, there'd be nobody there. And I used to be such a skeptic of all these things until I had that house.
I believe. See, I was a healthy skeptic, too, for a long time. But I've opened my mind to those possibilities. And based on the story you're telling, too, like, I don't think it's all bad. They're not all creepy trying to out. They're not out to get us necessarily.
No, in my case, it just sounded like people were having a good time.
Sure. Yeah, they want to keep having a good time in the old Dominion Inn.
Exactly.
So, and that went on the entire time you were there, Connor?
I was there for about 2.5 years. And yeah, the entire time I was there, I actually ended up telling the new buyers about it.
Right.
And they came back to me about 2 months later saying, you were right. This is really cool.
Wow. Wow. I love it. I love that. You see, I wish it's too bad you couldn't get it like a higher price for that. Right. You can have regular line dancing upstairs.
Oh, it was right on the main highway on a truck route for the Honda plant. There was no good price on that.
Connor, great to hear from you on the show. Thanks for calling in.
All right. You have yourself a good day, Mike. Thank you very much.
You as well, sir. Bye-bye. See, this is the other thing, and I think this is why my mind opened a little bit. Or maybe I opened it in this direction, right? Because our idea of spirits and or hauntings comes primarily, of course, from mass media and what we see depicted in movies and on TV. And these things are out to hurt us or scare us. Or I don't think that's always the case. I just think that they've either got some unfinished business or they just haven't made that transition to whatever comes after we're done here. We shake off this mortal coil of ours. Grant, what is your experience with the unexplained?
Well, I don't know if it's unexplained.
Okay, then I'm going to explain it to you.
Freeport, where I used to work at,
yeah.
The old part, I would have to clean up the basement. That's where the morgue is. I would have to go into the morgue and clean.
Oh, really?
And
that freaks me out just thinking about it, Grant.
And the basement, yeah, it was kind of creepy. It kind of made me think of in the hallways of Aliens, the pipes making all those weird sounds. And the old men building that you can see from King Street,
yep,
always had bats in them. And that was another place. It wasn't occupied every time, but whenever you had to go in there, you had to clean. And they actually did a horror movie in that building.
I'm not surprised. That, like, when you, because I knew you worked at Freeport. You've told us that before. And I thought right away, like, that is an old building in this community. And, oh, man, cleaning the basement. Like, did you have a choice, Grant? I might have asked somebody else to do it. Like, if it was me, I'd say, hey, Dev, our guy on the other side of the glass, can you go down? It's your turn to clean the basement. Or I would pull rank and say, I've been here 29 years. You've been here 29 months. You're going to clean the basement.
No, I wouldn't have a choice
either. Okay.
And then they would also bring the dead bodies on the same elevator that you're on.
No, dude. Thank you. Come on.
And you, I'd say no way. No, you can have it.
Exactly. You can have the elevator all to yourself, you and that corpse. Oh, dear. It is the day that we share the scary stories. Have you ever had an encounter with the unexpected, the unexplained, a paranormal experience? Tell us about it on the flip side. On the Mike Farwell Show, 570 News Radio and Rogers TV. Let's see if we can get one more spooky story in before noon. Peter, good morning.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
So I got a house story, and I'm sure a lot of people in Kitchener have actually seen this house. When it was about 22 years ago, my parents moved into this house. It's actually the big red house right beside the clock tower in Victoria Park.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And the first night we moved in there, a little backstory, we actually had one of those red caravans, one of those box ones. No features, no roll-down windows, nothing like that. Anyways, first night we were there, my brother and I were in our room. We were freezing cold, which was kind of weird right off the bat because it was like July. And the van starts honking like it has a car alarm.
Get out.
But it did not. Did not have a car alarm, did not have any special features, nothing like that. Just run of the mill. We all freaked out. We went downstairs. We went outside. We looked at the van. My dad opened the door. It just kept honking.
Okay,
as
Peter.
If someone was in the seat.
I'm so sorry, but I have to be to news on time. Can you hang on and finish this story? I want to hear more about this house because everybody knows it so well right after the news.
Okay, sure.
Okay, thank you. I really appreciate that. I can't be late for the news update, but we're going to hear the rest about the haunted house right beside Victoria Park coming up on the Mike Farwell Show. 570 News Radio.
Take out the papers and the trash, or you don't get no spending cash. If you don't scrub that kitchen floor, you
all that.
Just finish cleaning up your room. Let's see that dust fly with that broom. Get all that garbage out of sight. Or you don't go out Friday night. Daggity-yack.
Don't hold that.
Okay, let's get back to that story about the big red house right by the clock tower at Victoria Park in downtown Kitchener. Family moves in. The room is freezing, even though it's July. And the family car, even though it has no bells and whistles, starts honking and blaring like there's a car alarm going off. Family scoots downstairs in the dead of night, only to find there's nobody in the car. Peter will pick up the story for us. Thanks for waiting, Peter.
Yeah, so that was the first night. And so that one, right off the bat, it was kind of spooky. And I could go on all day about the spooky stuff that had happened in that house, but I'll keep it nice and short. And what this house was kind of looked like, it's like an old-style Victorian. You walk in, there's like a glorious mudroom with the glass doors. And all the doors have, holes and skeleton keys for them.
Yeah.
There's a big old laundry chute. Like well-style laundry chute that goes from the basement to the attic. And the creepiest part about this place, obviously, was the basement. It had a giant octopus furnace, but in the bottom of the basement, in the very back, there was this room that was just dirt. And then there was like cage bars in the corner of it. And we'd actually have groundhogs pop in, because it was just a dirt floor down there, and pop up and like make an appearance and then pop back down. So it was a weird house.
How long did you live there?
Not too long.
But it left an impression.
Oh, yeah. So the one story that's left an impression, and I've told quite a bit, is it happened to me and my brother. And it's one of those good stories, right, because it happened to both of us. So it's like we have each other to reassure that we weren't actually crazy and that this actually happened. So one day we were just sitting upstairs, second floor, and I was actually on the John, and my brother was just playing in his room. And then right beside our room is the attic door that goes upstairs to the attic. And it started opening on its own, just like, and I'm just sitting here. I assumed Oscar, my brother, was going up there. And he assumed the same thing, that I was either going up there or coming out of there. So, but he starts to get a little freaked out and investigates. And, he just says my name, like, hey, Peter? And then I'm confused because I hear him that he's in his room and not actually coming out of the attic or going in the attic. And then I'm like, okay, that's weird. And then so I go to, respond, and I was going to say what. But as soon as my lips form the W and I start to breathe the word what, bam, the door just slams shut.
Come on.
And then Oscar, or I don't know what I'm saying his name, but my brother, he starts, freaking out, obviously. And I'm just like, okay, I finished on the job, pulling my pants. And I'm like, okay, it's okay, I was just going to big brother mode. It's like, it's probably just the wind, we'll just go upstairs and investigate and we'll see if there's the window open. And, there wasn't. And, to this day, it's wonder what happened.
And to this day, you and your brother, whose name shall be left out, can still talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
I love it. Peter, thanks for sticking around and sharing the story.
No worries.
Enjoy your day. There you go. Another Halloween story for us on this October the 31st. Talkback Hour continues with Super Mario?
It's me, Mario. Let's go.
Kyle, is that you?
Yes.
Oh, my word. Oh, my word.
I dressed up as Super Mario for the weekend. Well, I thought it's Halloween, so I thought I'd be in character. Let's go, and me and Mario. Ho-ho! Me and Peach are so married, and that Bowser, I tell you. Ho-ho-ho! Let's go. You don't like it?
Is that how Mario really sounded, though?
I think so.
Okay.
Super Mario 64 he did. I don't know about the other ones, but I definitely, when I played N64, he sounded like that.
All right. I dig it. I dig it. Well done,
all
sir.
All I want to say is just happy Halloween, everybody, and enjoy your day, and let's go. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Indeed, bye-bye. I am enjoying my day because the big boss brought in full-size chocolate bars, and I crushed one of those. Mayor Jake, good afternoon, your worship.
Mike, sorry, I don't mean to bug you. But I had two more that I wanted to tell you, but I know I was kind of pinched for time. So I'll let you pick which one. Do you want to hear the lake story or the hospital story?
I want to hear them both.
Okay, so I'll make them quick. So the one at the lake, so my parents have a place up in Midland, right on Georgian Bay.
Beautiful.
And we are just, like, right on the water. It's a trailer park, but it's right on the water. And my best friend Brandon's dad went for a swim one night at, like, midnight, and this is in, like, July or August. And he said that, like, when he was swimming, some kid was splashing him or something. And it was a little odd because it was midnight, and he's getting splashed and all that. And he was looking around. There's no kids around. No towels, no parents, no kids. And he was so freaked out, he ran out of the water to find out that the owner's son drowned in the lake 40 years before that. And he's been so freaked out, he's never been back to the trailer park since. And this was, like, 20-plus years ago now.
That's the plot of a horror movie right there, Mary Jake.
It's terrifying. And just thinking that when I was, like, you know, I never really liked swimming. But the amount of time I spent in that water thinking that there's something that could have been lurking around definitely terrifies me. Not like the guy standing behind me, but the hospital story is my friend Alyssa, she's a hospice nurse. And unfortunately, she deals with a lot of death. And I asked her one time, I said, you know, have you seen anything unusual? Like, have you, seen anything? She goes, no, like, nothing. She's been doing this for 2-3 years at this point. So she calls me, like, a few months after I asked her that question. She goes, Jake, I have something to tell you, and this story's going to freak you out. I said, okay. She says, this guy, Bill, who was on this last, like, probably only had a few days left. But she got to know him really well. She was coming into work. He was leaving the hospital. So, where are you going? Oh, I'm all better now. I'm good. I'm going to go home now. Okay, give him a hug. It was kind of odd. She comes in, and she asks her, other nurse, oh, like, Bill left. They go, what? Yeah, Bill. No, Bill died 5 minutes ago.
Come on, Mayor Jake. What do you got to be way for?
That's a true story, and they have it on surveillance. I'm going to try to get her to send me the video so I can send it to you. There's a video of her talking to absolutely nobody. There's nobody there. And her hugging somebody. And then, so she ended up quitting right after that.
She quit because she hugged a spirit, a ghost.
Yeah, so she does. She's a nurse at Burlington Hospital. But she said she was completely freaked out. I got another horror story with my mother-in-law walking out of the shower, but we'll save that for another time.
Ayo, thank you, Mary Jake. We'll leave it on that note and have a little chuckle because I got a little bit of a chill when Mayor Jake told the story about his friend at the hospital and Bill walked out saying he's all better, only for her to go inside and realize that Bill had died 5 minutes earlier. That she caught him in the in-between. It's the Mike Farwell Show, your 12 o'clock talk back hour on this October 31st. 570 News Radio. I was getting candy from the newsroom. How long did I make you play this music there, Dev? A solid 60 seconds? Do I have 40 seconds? All right. I owe the company 40 seconds of time because I was pilfering the candy jar in the newsroom. Let's get back to the phones on your 12 o'clock talkback hour. James, good afternoon.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Good, good. I think I got a couple of Halloween tricks this morning. The first one was we have 3 different days in this region, a crazy layer of government that is, of fireworks. Cambridge has tonight, Kitchener has tomorrow, and the craziest one is Waterloo has, you can pick tonight or tomorrow.
Well,
people are going to do that.
That's really. So Waterloo, that's though, isn't it, James? Like, Waterloo just wants everything for everybody.
And my second trick is an upcoming postal strike. Who uses Canada Post anymore? Like, really? I'm encouraging everyone there to go see their parents or their grandparents, show them how to use e-cards, And if you're going to send anything this Christmas, use another courier just to show these people that it's ridiculous. Canada Post loses so much money every year, and the amount of raise that they want, and then the union head says, well, we want our members to retire in dignity. Mike, what does that mean? I have no idea.
I aspire to the same thing, if that matters for anything at all here, James. Like, I'd love to retire with dignity. Can I do that too?
I know. Yeah, I have no idea what that means in negotiations. I have no idea. They get every single holiday and more than most people. And I just don't understand. And you know what? Check your community box, everybody, on a Friday and see if there's actually anything in it, or the day before a holiday, and see if there's actually anything in it. I've never gotten mail those days, so I don't know what's going on there. But when I looked at that and said they were threatening next week to strike, I just shook my head. I couldn't believe it. Anyways, I like your thoughts on it.
Thanks, James. I appreciate the call. Those are a couple of great observations from the news of the day. I'll say this about a potential strike at Canada Post. Like, honestly, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's around, does it still make a sound? Like, how much would we really notice? And if you are somebody who relies heavily on it, I'm happy to hear that. But talk about a service, an industry, per se, that has been completely and utterly disrupted by the evolution of technology and our ability to communicate with one another sans a letter in the mail, right? We've come a long way from carrier pigeons and the teletype and all of those other things that communicate messages back and forth. I find the whole Canada Post thing fascinating myself. And I will also say, I can add to this, anecdotal as it may be, but I knew a guy that worked for said Crown Corporation. And let me tell you, there was a time that it was about as good a job as you could get in this life, right? You'd put in whatever hours it took you to complete your particular route. The pay was good. The benefits were excellent. The pension was outstanding. I used to go to the gym regularly, and I would work with this guy as I would work out. He would be finishing his overnight shift, and he'd be in there in the gym in the morning. And then I stopped seeing him because I stopped going to the gym. And I ran into him a few years later, just coincidentally, at a restaurant, and started chatting. I said, "Hey, how's life at Canada Post?" He said, "Oh, I pensioned out at 49. He had his 25 years in at the age of 49, and that was the end of that. That's not a bad gig if you can get it." Anyway, and on the fireworks thing, another excellent observation by James. When I heard the story this morning, my thoughts/reaction were different. I just thought, here we go again with our efforts to somehow, some way, control/legislate one's behavior. These are the days upon which you can set off fireworks. Meh. Whenever we get our hands on them, we tend to set them off. And so Diwali is one of those celebrations where fireworks are allowed in our municipalities. And as James points out, if you're in Waterloo, you could set them off tonight or tomorrow night. Take your pick, because that's how Waterloo likes things to be done. This is the Mike Farwell Show. It's your 12 o'clock talk back hour on 570 News Radio. Let's get right back to the phones on a busy talk back hour this Halloween day. Zoltan the Magnificent, good afternoon.
Mike the Bald, it's sure as hell nice to talk to you again.
You as well, sir.
But actually, it's a good bald, you know? It's not a bad bald.
Thank you.
You are a great everythinger that you do.
I'm an everythinger.
And I thank you. Anyway, look, in case no one mentions it, the letter carriers who carry things like stuffers, carry flyers, and so on and so on, they get extra money for that. And the people that stuff their bags also get extra money for that. No one really mentions that, how much money they get for it. It's a lot of money. So every hundreds of thousands of flyers that are delivered by these people, they get paid extra for that above and beyond their wages. And that comes from a letter carrier. And I thank you very much.
Thank you, Zoltan. Always good to hear from you. I did not know that aspect of the job. Mary, good afternoon.
Oh, I was going to say good morning. Oh, boy.
We've passed it. That, it is going fast, yes.
Yeah. You're busy as a one-arm paper hanger.
I know. I'm so sorry we had to cut you short before. I'm glad you're here again.
Well, it's okay. Well, so I
you're a sweetheart.
Was thinking when you were doing your paranormal thing, and I thought, well, I haven't got anything to add to that. And then I realized I do. My previous husband had a lung disease. He was at home on oxygen for at least 5 years. However, to get to the point, with the lung disease, he had a certain aroma, not a bad one, but just a certain smell. And then he passed away in July 1999. And I would smell that smell.
I'm not surprised.
Well, why?
Well, because it would be important to you, right?
Well, no, but so it was just for me. And then in December, I was making Christmas stuff, baking, and I put the CD on, and then it went off and went on to something else. And I thought, oh, well, there must be something wrong here. So I went and put the CD back on, and it went off again. And the song was, by 98 degrees, I Will Love You for the Rest of My Life. What do you think of that?
I think that somebody was sending you a message, young lady.
I do, too, and I told my daughter, and she said, oh, I wish I'd get something like that, but I still play the song, and yeah, it was so crazy.
I love it. It's
a
great story.
In a good way.
In a good way. Great story. I got to get you the way of the News Center for a 570 News update, and we continue your talk back hour on the Mike Farwell Show, 570 News Radio.
And spooky, they're all together ooky, the Addams Family. Their house is a museum, when people come to see them, they really are a scream, the Addams Family.
Not all the songs are completely creepy. Who doesn't love a little bit of the Addams Family? Gomez and Company. It is your 12 o'clock talk back hour, where you get to start the conversation. Got an idea? Got something going on in your neighborhood? Something chafing away at your chaps? We're here for it at 519-570-2545, star 570 and 1-800-570-5715. Back to the phones for Grant. Good afternoon, Grant.
I thought Kyle was kind of scary. I wouldn't want to be...
Who was scary?
Kyle, when he was...
Oh, Kyle, when he's trying to talk like Super Mario?
That sounds kind of scary. I wouldn't want to be alone walking down a street and hearing that. I think I would get kind of spooked out. And could not UPS and those other places, can they not deliver mail too?
Sure, you can have things delivered through other couriers. Absolutely, you can.
So I think if I'm a kind of post rep, I think I would be dangerous as to what I'm asking for, because in my opinion, and maybe a lot of callers will say, job security is not there anymore.
Yeah, you know what? I think that you're right about that. And we get into this an awful lot when we start talking about collective bargaining. Right? Negotiations between employees or unions and employers, and the way that technology and automation is disrupting workplaces. I mean, I've seen so much of that just in my industry in the time that I've been in it, because I'll remind you, and I was just talking with a student at Conestoga College about this yesterday. When I started out
in radio, my very first job was on the overnight shift from midnight until 6 a.m. And that's because they needed to have somebody in the radio station on the air at that time. And now computers are so prevalent and automation is so seamless that we do not need a person in the radio station at many times of the day where we used to need human beings to do the job. So, yeah, when it comes to Canada Post, I think it's an excellent example of something where we don't need to mail letters to one another anymore, right? I do believe long distance rates have come down quite a bit, even just for making phone calls, but we've got email, we've got text message, we've got all kinds of different ways of staying in touch with other people as opposed to just putting something in the post, as they say, and having it delivered by a mail carrier. Things have dramatically changed in that department. There is no question about it. Just thinking back on our Farwell Show 5 today, which is five little things that I let you know about to start the day. And we do it at the beginning of the show every day, just after 9 a.m. Of course, the Los Angeles Dodgers winning the World Series last night. The Yankees built up a 5-0 lead, and then the Dodgers would come back and win the game 7-6. But this is poetic justice, right? I confess, I had no idea it had happened, but I got together with a buddy last night, and we watched the beginning of the game. And so in seeing the pregame show before the game last night, they showed some highlights from game 4, the game that the Yankees had won. And it was the first time I had seen those yahoos in the stands at Yankee Stadium interfering with Mookie Betts of the Los Angeles Dodgers when he went to make a catch. So I'm sorry I'm a day late on this, but I couldn't believe it. Like, I understand that sometimes, especially given the nature of the game, that there is fan interference, an overly enthusiastic fan might reach into the field of play and interfere, whether accidentally or otherwise. But in this particular case, if you didn't see it, the Los Angeles Dodgers player, Mookie Betts, goes over into foul territory to make a catch at the wall and clearly does that. But as he's making the catch, he's into the first row, his arm anyway, is into the first row of seats. And these two jackwagons begin, it looked like the one guy was actually trying to pry the glove off of Mookie Betts' hand. He's bending at his wrist. Then the other guy goes in to help out and pop the ball out of Mookie Betts' glove. The umpires made the right call that the out had been recorded. But that's not the point. The point is, I mean, you might have grounds for a charge of assault against these fans. Like, that player could have been seriously hurt, his wrist sprained, broken. I don't know, the way they were clutching and grabbing and clawing at this guy's hand. And I'm thinking, like, what on earth possesses somebody to do that? I know you want the home team to win. And so when that player from the other team is coming over to make the catch, by all means, tell him he's going to drop it. Try to distract him. Do something. But you don't physically lay your hands on the player to try to pull the ball out of his glove or pull his glove off his hand. It was awful to see. And rightly so, those players were denied entry to the game last night, or those fans were denied entry to the game last night by the Yankees. They should be denied entry to any baseball game again ever. Like, that's a hard line for me. If you cross that, I'm sorry, but you're never welcome back in a baseball stadium ever, because clearly you cannot be trusted. You cannot control yourself. It was awful to watch. I'm glad they weren't there for game 5. I hope they never get to go back to another baseball game. Jack wagons like that. It's just a game, for crying out loud. This is the Mike Farwell Show. Your 12 o'clock talk back hour, 570 News Radio. The Talk Back Hour is your opportunity to start the conversation. Whatever's on your mind, let us know just by giving us a phone call. Back to the phones we go. Rudy, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mike. I get in my car at 2:30 a.m. in the morning, and I put on 570,
and I'm listening then to Amy Lawrence.
I love Amy. She's so good.
Oh, yeah, she's terrific. And her people were saying that the guy actually tried to take the glove off Mookie, eh?
That's what it looked like to me.
Yeah, I didn't actually see it, but that's what she was saying. And then they ejected to two guys. Now, a reporter after was in a bar, and those two guys were in the bar. And he asked the guy about it, and they said, well, if Mookie comes around this bar and that, we'll give him a beat down. So that's the mentality they were dealing with.
Yeah, it sounds like a couple of fans from the Bronx for sure, doesn't it?
Yeah, and maybe a couple of brewskis in there, too many.
Well, you know, and that's what I originally thought, because like I said, I was seeing the highlight last night for the first time. I missed it the night before, so I was about 24 hours behind. But this happened in the first or second inning. If they were already liquored up at the game by that time, come on.
Have a great day, Mike.
Thanks, Rudy. You too. Good to hear from you. And thanks for listening to Amy Lawrence on our overnight hours. She does do terrific work with the CBS Sports Radio that we run through the night, and lots of interesting insight and analysis. Jim, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Mike. Good afternoon. Just a couple of really quick things. First of all, I think it was Boston had the curse of the Bambino. Now the Yankees have the curse of the Judge. And more importantly,
I like it.
the Yankees showed a lot of class. They booted out those two goofballs, and then on game five, they had given those two seats to a young fellow that was undergoing cancer treatment and his buddy.
Yep, agreed. It was a smart move.
That's all I wanted to say.
All right, Jim, thanks for that. Yeah, good PR move there for sure. As my buddy said last night, though, and we were watching this and we heard the same story reported by Hazel May, actually, on Sportsnet. Wouldn't it be great if the team just did that, like, every game? Do you think they do? Do you think there are seats reserved? Good seats, perhaps? In every baseball stadium or every sporting venue for cancer patients or, I don't know, other things like that. I just wonder, why just do it in this case? But an excellent response to the Jack Wagonry. And I'll say it again, like, I don't care if those guys ever see another baseball game, ever, the way they behaved. Ian, good afternoon.
Hey, Mike, I kind of missed a bit on your talking about some scary things. And, you know, I was going to mention the Leafs are playing tonight. That's kind of scary.
Hey, settle down. Settle down or I'll hang up this phone.
And I just came from Tesla, Kitchener, and the Cybertrucks have arrived, if you want to say that that's kind of scary.
What's the Cybertruck?
The Cybertrucks, you know, those big triangular weird things, you know, help you make whatever in math. But
I'm honestly, I have a Cybertruck?
Yeah. You've not heard of these things.
No.
The triangular-looking truck that they kind of look like something out of Blade Runner. And
wait, this is a vehicle that's going to be on our road?
You got it. They will next week be giving deliveries. There's four of them right now at the Tesla Kitchener. And
all right.
I don't know. I'm indifferent on them. I kind of like them, and I kind of like, I don't know. You know, it's check it out. It's an interesting vehicle and that. But I wanted to bring up, though, just in terms of scary places, when I toured with my band, we played Port Dover a heck of a lot. And if you know the Norfolk, unfortunately, it's torn down now because of, go figure, condos. But the Norfolk actually had downstairs the Brig, and the Brig was an old prison, I think from late 1800s, early 1900s. In fact, our favorite band, Rush, played there at one point. But the staff there always told me that after everything was done and they were closing up, no one wanted to go downstairs because they said it was, like, really eerie. They would hear things. They would see shadows move. And it just got to a point. It wasn't just one staff member. It was everybody had an experience. And unfortunately, like I said, it's ripped down now. But it used to be an old prison. So, you know, I think one staff member said they heard, like, chains. They heard rattling of the bars. So I don't know. I do kind of believe in some of this stuff. I found it interesting your guy talking about the dancing at his house that he had bought. I thought, you know, that's pretty cool, actually. I would enjoy that.
Yeah, I think I would, too. Have a good time. Have a party upstairs.
Exactly. As long as it doesn't go too late.
Exactly.
But, hey, whatever. Yeah. Thanks, Mike. Have a good one.
Thanks, Ian. I guess when you're a ghost, you don't have a bedtime, right? Because
you don't get tired anymore. Judah sends an email to Mike at 570news.com. About 5 years ago, I was looking after my elderly uncle. I would come to his apartment, cook meals, clean, etc. One day when I arrived, just before I buzzed him, I heard a voice say my name, which freaked me out. When he didn't answer, I used the key to enter. He had fallen and was deceased. The whole thing is a nerve-wracking memory. It would be. So he called out to you from the other side, Judah. You see what happened there? Good grievous with all the ghosts in this town. This is the Mike Farwell Show, 570 News Radio.
Something strange. Come with us and you will see. This our town of Halloween. This is Halloween.
I wonder how many kids are going to come to the door tonight. Historically, we've never even had 10 visits to our front porch, which is fine with me because that just means more candy for me. But I wonder why we go through the exercise year after year. I love it. I can't wait to see all the cutie patooties in their costumes tonight. We'll see how it turns out on this October the 31st. Wrapping up our talk back hour for another day, Phil is with us. Good afternoon, Phil.
Good afternoon, Mike. True story here. A few years ago, an elderly gentleman I know, he was in his house, in his kitchen, and he collapsed. And he was unconscious, and the paramedics were called, and he was dead. But they revived him. So the next time I saw him, I asked him, while you were on the other side, did you ever learn, did the Toronto Maple Leafs ever win the Stanley Cup again? And he said, I wasn't dead that long. I don't know.
Why you got to be this way, Phil? Why you got to do this to me? Why?
Well, I'm a Leaf fan, too. There was some divine intervention.
Oh, I true used story. To. Okay, true story, says Phil. Do I put on a sign before I come to work every day? Is that kick me in the ass every chance you get? Is that what the sign says, huh? I love you for it. That's what it means we're getting along, right? But that, like, that's a drive-by if ever there was one. At least you're not mentioning the team that shall not be named. Asif, my friend, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon, Mike. How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
Good.
Good.
You remember my story yesterday, the one where me and my mom saw the same ghost?
Oh yeah, you had it was in the bedroom, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if it's only me that can see it because one day I was walking with my wife, just down a stroll, and in front of me, like it was around like 8 o'clock nighttime, and I saw a dark guy like run across me. I told her, I was like, "Did you see that?" She's like, "What? What are you talking about?" I was like, "Oh God."
So you're the only one that gets to see it.
Yeah, basically.
Now I'm starting to wonder, Asif, is it real, do you think?
I don't know. That's why I don't know now anymore.
Thanks for the call.
No worries, how
good. You too. This is the thing. If we're the only one that sees it, is it just us? I don't know. But when you get your story corroborated like Peter did before, telling us about that scary house that he once lived in, next to the clock tower in Victoria Park in downtown Kitchener, he and his brother shared the same paranormal experience. I hope something spooky, in a good way, happens to you today, gives you a lasting memory of Halloween 2024. Be nice to the kids, be nice to the people from whom you are soliciting candy. Let's all have a safe time. Let's all have a good time. And let's all reconvene here tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, okay? I'm going to talk to a couple that's been running a local business for more than 40 years, and now they dive, pun intended, into retirement. That and so much more on our program tomorrow. Devin Robertson is our guy on the other side of the glass. My name is Mike Farwell. Bye for now.